It was the largest environmental bankruptcy in U.S. history. In December, the American smelting and refining company, ASARCO, agreed to pay nearly $2 billion to settle claims for hazardous waste pollution at more than 80 sites around the country. Cleanup will begin this year on one of ASARCO's most notorious properties, the copper smelter in El Paso, Texas. The aim is to remove toxins from the soil and groundwater, but as NPR's John Burnett reports, the legacy of bitterness in the community will be harder to erase.
Driving through El Paso on Interstate 10, you can't miss it. There on a bluff, a stone's throw from the Rio Grande, the old iron and copper smelter sits like a moldering Soviet factory. Time was the 120-year-old smelter, where metals are extracted from ore, was a pillar of El Paso's economy and one of the best jobs in town. Miguel Beltran, 82, is a former maintenance worker.
You can't get no job here in El Paso compared to ASARCO. ASARCO, the best place to work. We're just like a family.
ASARCO was part of the mining empire of the storied Guggenheim family that made the steel that helped the U.S. military win two world wars. But the world changed. Widespread opposition to ASARCO in El Paso and across the river in Juarez, Mexico, became a case study of a community's fight for environmental justice. Last year, the EPA turned down ASARCO's request for a new air emissions permit. Today, many people see the smelter as an environmental outlaw for contaminating central El Paso with dangerous metals and for secretly and illegally burning hazardous waste. Jim and Debbie Kelly stand on the slag field, looking up at an 800-foot smokestack emblazoned with ASARCO. They belong to an anti-smelter group called Get the Lead Out.
It was the largest smokestack in the country, and there were people in town who proudly proclaimed, "We live in a place with the largest smokestack."
They marketed it very well, and the people of El Paso were brainwashed to believe that this was the most wonderful thing El Paso could possibly have, was this tall, polluting, contaminating smokestack.
In December, Texas appointed a trustee to clean up the 400-acre site, which is contaminated with a periodic table of heavy metals: lead, arsenic, cadmium, chromium, selenium, and zinc. ASARCO is now a bankrupt subsidiary of the mining giant Grupo Mexico. The company paid $52 million to a custodial trust as part of its bankruptcy settlement. The plan now is to sell off the plant for scrap, isolate the contaminated soil, treat the poisoned groundwater, and finally cap the whole site with asphalt. A big question is what to do with the iconic brick smokestack. John Cook is mayor of El Paso.
You know, I would love to leave the smokestack there as a reminder, sort of a bookmark in history.
But whose history? The United States or Mexico's? Cook and other longtime El Pasoans remember when the wind would shift to the south, the smelter would crank up production, and the smokestack would gush dirty yellow smoke directly into Juarez.
They could basically pollute as much as they wanted because it was going into another country that had no ability to stop us.
As a result, sulfur dioxide and heavy metals fell on the colonias and schools and playgrounds of El Paso's sister city, where federal and state regulators had no jurisdiction. State Senator Elliot Shapley was one of those who led the fight to close down ASARCO.
It is very clear that a majority of what came out of that flue and was deposited over the 100 years landed in Mexico.
Colonia Ladrillera in Juarez is located less than half a mile from the smelter. People here complained of skin rashes, allergies, and asthma when ASARCO was operating. Longtime resident Consuelo Renteria is asked what she thinks when she sees the great chimney to the north with the barren Franklin Mountains in the distance.
Pues yo creo que representa coraje, diga. Porque dañó mucha gente, oiga.
I think it's a symbol of our rage, she says, because it hurt many people here. The people of the United States, they'll fix everything over there. And here, what will happen? Nothing. The corporate office of ASARCO in Tucson, Arizona, did not respond to an interview request. With the bankruptcy settlement, the company has a new CEO and has turned its attention to its remaining three copper mines in Arizona and a copper refinery in Amarillo, Texas. A statement on its website says, at ASARCO, environmental considerations are, quote, a way of life within the company. To this day, some former workers remain angry at the public thrashing the company endured. Pat Escondon and all the men in his family worked at ASARCO most of their adult lives.
Everybody was healthy. I even had my uncles were there. And they're all passed away in their late 80s. My dad was 87. I've never had a headache.
Despite his enduring company loyalty, Asarco's impact on public health in El Paso is irrefutable. A landmark 1972 study by the Centers for Disease Control found that more than half the children living within a mile of the smelter had levels of lead in their blood four times today's acceptable limit. A follow-up study determined that these outwardly healthy children had lower IQs and slower reflexes. The El Paso lead study was so influential that it contributed to the EPA's decision in 1973 to phase lead components out of gasoline. A similar study in Juarez found a mirror image of elevated blood lead levels in Mexican children. After these findings, Asarco discontinued its lead smelting operation in El Paso. To date, more than 1,000 properties surrounding the plant have been remediated or cleaned up. One of them was the home of Yvette Ramirez Ammerman, whose daughter Elisa was found to have lead in her blood.
She's 9 now, and she's had some issues. She's having trouble with math. She has some behavioral issues. It's hard to know whether or not that's as a result of the lead.
Ammerman, who now lives with her family in Albuquerque, is asked how she feels about Asarco today. Her response represents the anger and helplessness that's still palpable in El Paso.
Well, I can't say that on the radio. I would have their children be poisoned and have them feel it. No, I wouldn't do that. But there's a part of me that would like to say, in your greed, you allowed this to happen.
After more than a century of ore smelting and decades of conflict with regulators and the community, Asarco is about to become history. El Paso must decide what to do with the prime real estate after the remediation is completed. In Tacoma, Washington, and Omaha, Nebraska, toxic industrial sites belonging to Asarco were cleaned up and reused for condos, office buildings, and a convention center. In El Paso, once the poison has been buried, they can begin to look to the future. John Burnett, NPR News.
See a timeline of Asarco's history, which dates back to the 19th century, at our website, npr.org.
Flying pandas. The star resident of the National Zoo is leaving Washington next week. 4-year-old panda Taishan will board the FedEx Panda Express to Chengdu, China. Today, the National Zoo is throwing him a going-away party. Donald Moore is the associate director at the zoo's Department of Animal Care, and he joins us by phone from his office. Donald, thank you for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
So tell me a little bit more about Taishan's trip. Where does he fly from? Is it first class? Is this a solo trip?
Well, let's start at the zoo. Taishan will go into his holding crate, which he's been trained to go into on command and be very comfortable in there. It's a large steel crate. And then he'll go from there to Dulles Airport, where FedEx will have a 777 on the ground. And Tai will go from Dulles to Chengdu, China, direct in about a 14-and-a-half-hour journey.
And did you just say FedEx? The panda is flying FedEx.
The panda is flying FedEx Express, you bet.
How did that come about?
FedEx heard we were shipping pandas, and we've had a good cooperative relationship with FedEx. They often ship animals safely for us, and they decided to fly the National Zoo panda back to Chengdu for free.
Well, that's the operative word there.
Now,
I was also reading that giant pandas are actually the national symbol of China, and I've read that China actually maintains ownership of all giant pandas. So, like most, Taishan's actually on loan. What happens to him when he gets back to Chengdu?
That's right. Just like all bald eagles in the United States that are in captivity are on loan from the U.S. government, the giant pandas are on loan from the Chinese government. And when he goes back to Chengdu, he'll be managed by the Chinese giant panda breeding centers, and he'll help to save his own species by being a breeder.
Donald Moore is the National Zoo's Associate Director for Animal Care. Donald Moore, thank you for talking with us.
You're so welcome.
And there's another panda party going on in Atlanta today for Meilan, a 3-year-old giant panda. Some of her biggest fans will get the chance to make farewell cards and celebrate her time at Zoo Atlanta, where she's lived since she was born there in September 2006. She will join Tyshawn on the FedEx flight to Chengdu. Zoo Atlanta plans to pack Meilan some snacks for the flight, including more than 100 pounds of bamboo, sweet potatoes, fruits, and nutritional cookies. For more on giant pandas, visit npr.org. And now to the sport of hunting. To some, deer are a beautiful symbol of nature. To others, they're a nuisance and a hazard to public health and the ecosystem. Some towns, particularly in the suburbs, are so fed up, they're opening up their parks to hunters. Craig LaMolt from member station WSHU in Connecticut reports.
The path is still lit by the early morning moonlight as Howard Kilpatrick starts his hike.
We're going to head down this trail. We want to lift our feet up and put them down gently and try to walk on the part of the trail. There's not many leaves, so we can get out there as quietly as possible.
Kilpatrick hikes up a hill on some private property and settles in next to a tree overlooking a valley. He stands silent and still for about 15 minutes, and then from below the faint sound of hooves. He raises his .30-06 caliber rifle, looks through the scope, and holds it perfectly still. He sets off down the hill where he finds a dead deer. It's average-sized with short antlers. While Kilpatrick will feed his family with the deer meat he brings home, he also has a professional interest in it.
I'm a wildlife biologist, and I'm responsible for Connecticut's deer management program.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture says 20 years ago, there were fewer than 500,000 deer in the country. That's ballooned to more than 17 million deer. Officials in Connecticut and nearby states say they're seeing more towns turning to deer management programs. Kilpatrick estimates there are around 60 deer per square mile in some Connecticut counties. He'd like to bring that number down to a more manageable 8 to 15 deer per square mile.
They cause a lot of deer vehicle accidents. They cause damage to agricultural crops. They play an important role in the spread of Lyme disease. And they can impact, you know, our natural ecosystems by overbrowsing and basically eliminating some plant species.
If you really want to solve those problems, there's a lot of other places you need to be looking.
That's Nancy Rice. She works for the group Friends of Animals, which is based in Connecticut. Rice lives in the town of Fairfield, which recently changed regulations to allow hunting in the town's parks and woods. Some nearby towns are hiring sharpshooters or archers, or allowing limited numbers of hunters on specific days. Rice argues that there are better ways than hunting to reduce the number of deer-car collisions.
Fencing, lighting, street signs telling people, you know, you're in a deer zone, slow down. These are the places we should be looking.
Deer contraception programs are used to control the population in some places. But wildlife management experts say that works best in small areas and can be prohibitively expensive. Carolyn Eberhardt lives across the street from a park in Fairfield. Hunting scares her, and she says if it's allowed here, she'll sell her house.
You know, I don't think any parent would feel comfortable with their kid wandering around doing something as innocent as walking through a park on a snowy day and then getting a bullet in their head or an arrow on their back.
Connecticut's Department of Environmental Protection says it's had no reports of accidents during controlled hunts and argues that hunting is the only efficient and economical way to manage the deer population. But not everyone agrees the population needs managing. And even if they did, there'd still be debate about whether or not hunting is the answer. For NPR News, I'm Craig LaMolt in Fairfield, Connecticut.
Heavy rain has soaked many areas in California this winter, but the precipitation hasn't alleviated the state's long-term drought. Many districts still have federally mandated water cutbacks, so they've raised rates and are trying to create incentives for better water conservation. Reporter Jennifer Bauman visited one water district in Southern California to check out a billing system that encourages people to use less water and penalizes them for wasting it.
This is getting to be a bit much.
Irvine homeowner Peter Bretzker is, like most of us, paying his water bill without much question. Then one month, he got a big shock, a bill that suddenly more than doubled. The Irvine Ranch Water District charged Bretzker 8 times more than his base rate for the portion of his water use labeled wasteful.
I mean, you can see it in the the bill you guys send us, which is really good. It's scary.
So Bretzger was motivated to get some free help.
Well, I'm with the conservation department, so I'll be conducting the audit.
Water conservation analyst Natalie Pavlovsky is examining Bretzger's upscale home to check for any potential leaks. The first stop is the toilet in the downstairs bathroom, where she drops a blue dye tablet into the holding tank.
If there's any leaks, this water will leak into the bowl, and that water will turn blue.
Turns out two of Bretzger's three toilets have minor leaks, but that's not enough to explain the recent wasteful water use. So the next stop is the timer for the outdoor sprinklers.
So 7 minutes for the first station, 10 minutes for the second station. It's all very high.
During the drought of the early 90s, the Irvine Ranch Water District abandoned one-size-fits-all, flat-rate pricing and started using a system based not just on how much water you use, but on how much you ought to use. Conservation manager Fiona Sanchez describes it as allocation-based billing designed to discourage waste.
And what it does is it rewards conservation with very low rates, but if you use more than your allocation, then you will get a very strong financial signal to tell you that you need to conserve.
Each customer's water allocation is based on the number of residents, lot size, and climate. Users who exceed their customized allocation face three levels of penalty charges for inefficient, excessive, or wasteful water use. A wasteful water user will see their base rate jump from just over a dollar to more than $9 per 100 cubic feet.
We're shocking bills, but the good news is that when they call in, when they get the shock, we're able to really help them.
Great. Okay, so we found a few more things.
Pavlovsky conducts two or three residential audits a day.
And then I'll leave you with this packet. It's our conservation information. There's a key to type sprinklers.
Since the system's been in place, personal water consumption in the district has been reduced by 40% and landscaping water use by 60%. Drew Beckwith, water policy analyst with Western Resource Advocates, says these kinds of penalties are a powerful tool for water districts to push people to conserve.
From our perspective, that's certainly one of the number one things that they should be looking at.
Despite higher startup costs, allocation-based billing systems are expanding throughout the West and even gaining favor in some drought-parched states in the Southeast. For NPR News, I'm Jennifer Ballman.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
President Obama's budget made it clear he is serious about nuclear energy. His proposal? To triple the government money available to guarantee loans for companies that want to build nuclear plants. As NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports, the president's commitment delights some electric companies, but upsets some of his strongest supporters.
Building a nuclear plant is kind of like trying to get a mortgage these days to build a house.
Maybe I'm going to have somebody co-sign the loan. Now, they never pay any money, but they're there just in case.
That's James Connaughton, Executive Vice President of Constellation Energy. His company is hoping to get loan guarantees to build another reactor at its nuclear plant in Calvert Cliffs, Maryland.
We just need the federal backstop in order to attract the private sector investment that will make that possible.
Most companies say they can't build the plants without the loan guarantees. Congress and President Bush created the Nuclear Loan Guarantee Program about 5 years ago. The $18 billion already promised probably would get only a few new plants built. It won't start the nuclear renaissance electric companies want. But the companies say the additional $36 billion the president is proposing could do that, and help Mr. Obama meet his goals of slashing greenhouse gas emissions.
Nuclear is the only generation out there that produces power 24/7 with no carbon emissions at all.
Tom Williams of Duke Energy says wind and solar only produce electricity when the wind is blowing or the sun is shining. So he says nuclear power is needed to help the country cut greenhouse gases 80% by 2050. That's what the president and many scientists say is necessary to help avert catastrophic climate change. The president's nuclear proposal could play another crucial role in helping him address climate change. It could help woo Republicans and moderate Democrats to support a sweeping global warming law. The House passed a bill last year, but similar legislation is stuck in the Senate. Williams says the loan guarantees could improve its odds.
There's a lot of support for new nuclear from the people who are currently not supporting the climate bill, and by offering up this, it should help bridge the gap.
If you offer a bunch of utilities $54 billion in loan guarantees, they will probably round up a few senators to support you. That's correct.
That's Carl Pope, the executive director of the Sierra Club Environmental Group.
That's how Washington's working these days. That doesn't mean I like it.
Pope and many other environmental activists usually support President Obama, but they oppose his loan guarantee proposal. They stress that nuclear plants are inherently dangerous because the waste from them stays hazardous for hundreds of thousands of years, and the country still hasn't come up with a long-term plan to store the stuff. Plus, Pope says nuclear plants are so expensive to build that they're a bad economic risk for taxpayers.
They need the loan guarantees because investors are afraid that they'll never finish the plants, or that the plants will cost twice as much as they were supposed to, and will never be able to sell affordable electricity.
Still, Pope says loan guarantees for the nuclear industry would not sour environmental groups on a climate bill.
I don't think these kinds of loan guarantees would push us into opposition to a climate bill that would otherwise save the planet.
But even if the president's nuclear overture wins over a few Republicans and moderate Democrats, the climate bill still faces a lot of other hurdles. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
All Things Considered continues in a moment.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Major snowstorms are set to bury the mid-Atlantic states this weekend after record snowfalls in December. Last month, California was awash in rain, and the Gulf states, too, have seen heavy weather lately. This is not just a run of bad luck. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, much of this winter's nasty weather can be explained in two words: El Niño.
Scientists knew last summer that this was going to be an El Niño year. And last December, Californians learned, the hard way, that it was no ordinary El Niño.
It was a wet and wild commute for drivers across California as road crews tried to keep ahead of a massive winter storm.
That report from the Associated Press was one of a litany on California television as back-to-back rainstorms inundated the state. The Mid-Atlantic got much the same treatment, though it came down as snow. The strong El Niño and the subsequent precipitation is a result of something that started thousands of miles out in the Pacific Ocean.
Ocean temperatures across the equatorial and tropical Pacific Ocean are somewhere upwards of 2 degrees Celsius above average. So we've had what we would characterize as a strong El Niño.
That's Mike Halpert, Deputy Director of the Climate Prediction Center at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Scientists at the center say this is the strongest El Niño since the 1997-98 winter. What happens is that unusually warm surface temperatures in the western Pacific move east. That changes the heating pattern of the atmosphere, which in turn pulls the Pacific jet stream farther south. A jet stream is a fast and narrow current of air that travels high up in the atmosphere.
And that jet stream is where we see a lot of storminess typically, and then we saw a very classical case of that. A super strong jet extended all the way across the Pacific with storms impacting California one after the other.
A strong El Niño also alters another jet stream nearer to the equator and brings more storms to the Gulf area. In fact, a strong El Niño plays havoc with weather from Indonesia to the Atlantic, but in different ways. Indonesia gets unusually dry weather, and in fact, fires in parts of Indonesia have been frequent recently. Peru, on the west coast of South America, tends to get what California gets, flooding rains. Halpert says storms are local events, and no single storm can be attributed directly to the phenomenon.
One way to think of it is that El Niño conditions the atmosphere for these types of storms.
Halpert also points out that scientists don't know yet whether climate change is influencing the frequency or strength of El Niños. Scientists say El Niño will likely persist another month or two. That usually means drier than usual weather in the Pacific Northwest and Ohio Valley, wetter in the west and southwest, and colder in the southeast. El Niño has done some good in the southwestern U.S., for example.
Nobody can remember seeing such a small amount of drought on the map. So this El Niño has taken a pretty big bite out of some pretty severe drought conditions that had developed last summer.
And by altering jet streams, El Niño apparently also helped moderate last year's hurricane season in the Atlantic. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.